Well, you guys know we're picking up this morning in the book of Esther in chapter 5. We have been looking at this young Jewish girl who was an orphan girl, and the fact that she's an orphan is not quite enough to represent the situation she was in, because she's not an orphan in her homeland where there might be some relative or somebody who's at least closely associated of the same kind of heritage and lifestyle as hers who could take her in. But she's orphaned in Persia, where the Israelis have been taken, or the Hebrews have been taken into captivity. So this is the place where she has been growing up, and she finds herself now as queen, this young girl. But she has this relative who's taken on this role sort of like a stepfather, a cousin Mordecai. And he has been giving her quite a bit of direction, even once she has become queen. But then there's this man who has got such vile intent against Mordecai and all of the Jews to see them exterminated, Haman. And when Mordecai finds about the plan and comes back to Esther, and he's encouraging her that she needs to do something. We see wonderfully through this story the way that God will work via his providence. And if you're not used to what providence is or what it even means, hopefully by the time we are done with this series, if not even today, you will have a good understanding of what it is. And certainly my hope this morning is that your faith today will be encouraged as we understand how God's providence works. Sometimes in life, we get a bit of a drought. Sometimes we get a bit of a rainstorm. And it can affect us in different ways. But if we can trust that God is in control, that God knows what he's doing, and by his providence he is working, it should enrich and encourage our faith. So here we come to chapter 5, 6, and 7 in the book of Esther, and we see that Esther has become ready to approach the king, even though she has every reason to be concerned, as is the law of the land. She could lose her life. If I perish, I perish, she told us last week. Now, there's a problem here for her when she wants to go and talk to the king, because she wants to talk to the king about this man, Haman, who has deceived the king. He's his right-hand man, and yet she wants to now tell the king, your right-hand man has deceived you. Yet Esther herself, as queen, in a way, has already also deceived the king, because she has kept her identity hidden from him. So she hasn't outright gone out and said she belongs to some other group or heritage, but in her own way, she also has deceived him. And now she needs to accuse somebody else of the same very deceit. It puts her in a tricky position. And she's going to have to ask him to reverse a law that they have put in place to be irreversible. How do you ask somebody to reverse something that is intended to be irreversible? And this has got to be a blow to the king's pride. Because the king has chosen, he is king over everything. He chooses who his advisors are. He's chosen Haman. He has listened to this man. He has agreed to his plan. And now his wife's going to come along and say to the king, your plan stinks and it needs to change. That's going to be a blow to this man's pride. So she's got herself in a difficult position. Let me just remind you of the first two verses here in chapter 5 as we start out. It says that Esther put on her royal robes and she stood in the inner court of the palace in front of the king's hall. The king was sitting on his royal throne. And as he was sitting on his royal throne in the hall, facing the entrance, and when he saw Queen Esther standing in the court, he was pleased with her. And he held out his gold scepter that was in his hand. And so she approached. There's no request just yet coming from Esther, but that she knows she's got some favor with the king that she can go in. And I wonder about this, because when she first comes in and he is ready, he says, what is it, my queen? You know what? Up to half of my kingdom I am happily give you. But she doesn't say anything, even though he's already extending the scepter and saying, I'll give you whatever you want. And she gives no request at all. So I'm not sure why she doesn't give her request right off. My best guess is that she is testing the waters. testing the waters just a little bit and get him into an agreeable mood. And you're going to see that she stalls a little bit in giving her request. Now, I'm not entirely sure what her reason is. It could just well been that when the queen got there, she was very terrified. And even though the golden scepter had been extended, I can't say anything in this moment. I'm scared to death. But we do know that God did have a reason. If Esther did not have a reason, if she was just froze, but God has a reason to delay the request, and it's in his providence. And I hope for you to see it more and more as we go through the text. God has a reason. Her delay is preparing the king. You know, her petition is very, very serious of what she's going to ask him. And the fact that it gets delayed probably has some effects on the king to start knowing, this is something pretty big that my queen has got in mind. We have to go to this banquet before we can even get the request. So then we go to verse 5 and we see the first banquet. Verse 5. He says, bring Haman at once, the king said, so that we may do what Esther has asked. So the king and Haman went to the banquet that Esther had prepared. But if you read the following verses there, you will see again, Esther does not make her petition. She's had a chance. She's prepared the banquet now so she can make another chance, but again, she says nothing about it. And why is this? Again, we don't know. It doesn't tell us in the scripture why Esther stalls. But we can have confidence that God has a reason. Do you ever have that feeling in your own life where you feel like, here we go, and this is it, and now's the time, and it doesn't happen? It's like false labor. It's now. Well, it's not now. I think about that young man ready to ask out that girl, and everything is just right, and everything is perfect. And now? No, doesn't happen. Why not now? And that poor young man spends all night arguing with God. How come this? How come that? Why didn't it work? Why didn't it work? And God has a reason. Not yet. The path is good. Not yet. In his providence, he has a reason. So the tension is increasing. Now, particularly, one of the things that God is going to show us where his providence needs to take hold of the situation is the tension between Haman, who was the king's right-hand man, and Mordecai, who was Esther's relative who was taking care of him. He is the reason that he's decided he wants to kill all the Jews. Now, this tension that is between them needs to increase. So we jump to verse 9, and we see the tension between these two men is increasing. God has a reason for that. It says that Haman went out that day, and he was happy. He was in high spirits. But when he saw Mordecai at the king's gate and observed that he neither rose nor showed fear in his presence, he was filled with rage against Mordecai. Nevertheless, Haman restrained himself, and he went home. So he called together his friends and Zeresh, his wife, and Haman boasted to them about his vast wealth, his many sons, all the ways the king had honored him and how he had elevated him above the other nobles and the officials. And that's not all, Haman added. I am the only person that Queen Esther has invited to accompany the king to the banquet she gave, and she has invited me along with the king tomorrow to another. But all of this gives me no satisfaction as long as I see that Jew, Mordecai, sitting in the king's gate. And his wife Zeresh and all his friends said, we'll have a gallows built 75 feet high and ask the king in the morning to have Mordecai hanged on it. And then go with the king to the dinner and be happy. And this suggestion delighted Haman. He had the gallows built. Now, the effects of this first banquet are evident on how they affected Haman. For him, it is a real head trip. He doesn't mind bragging to his wife and to all of his friends. I am a very special person. I am the only person been invited to this banquet with the king and the queen. So he thinks he's very, very privileged. This is an interesting moment of perspective. And sometimes you will find yourself in this kind of a moment. Every once in a while, you'll be in a situation where you are forced to address somebody who seems like they are of a higher standing of you. Now, in this situation, Queen Esther still likely very much feels like that little orphan girl. It wasn't long before this that she couldn't hardly do anything without getting instructions from her relative Mordecai. She's just a little girl. And who is this man that I have to go up against? But yet it's all perspective, because in Haman's position, he sees, well, she's the queen. And it's really quite something. So they're actually on level playing fields, and she's actually above him. But in her perspective, she may not feel it. Now, Haman, he's just got his head filled with pride. He's just swimming. He goes and he speaks to his family. I have everything. Look at the many sons that I have. Look at all the riches I have and the wealth that I have. Look at how I have been elevated in the king's court. I've even been invited to this special banquet. And he is very much full of pride. He thinks he has the world by the tail, and everything is good except for Mordecai. It's just made the man furious. I have an interesting thing in my house right now. I don't know if you guys are suffering this or not. Are you guys suffering from mosquitoes? Oh my goodness. The mosquitoes in our yard. I don't know why we're blessed with extra. I don't know. And they're so beautifully small that they can go right through my screen, I think. So when I am trying to sleep at night, I sleep for a minute or two, and then I can hear this right. Oh, it drives me just about batty. Last night I had a pillow over my head to keep it. This expression that we get about having a fly in the ointment, that one little filthy bug, and it gets in that spot that's supposed to be good, and it ruins the whole thing, like the mosquito trying to ruin my sleep. And for Haman, he sees Mordecai like this. He is that one little bug. If Haman truly is a man of significance and of power, he should be able to walk right past that man and just ignore him. What do I care about you? You are nothing. I will go about in all of my own significance and just ignore you. But he can't. He can't. It's making him furious. He's having a major, major mood swing. It says here in the text that he goes away from Esther's banquet very happy, very proud, very pleased. And then he sees Mordecai and he drops from his happiness to rage. There's a person who needs to learn just a little bit about some self-control. If people don't have any self-control over our emotions, if your emotions are carrying you and taking you wherever they want to take you, you are in trouble. You are not a trustworthy vessel if that is the case. So Haman got home and he unloaded on his family. So the solution, which is stunning, coming from his wife and friends, you should just kill the man. Build a gallows, have him killed. But this is what people of power get like. You would read about this elsewhere in the scriptures. Do you guys remember King Ahab and his lovely wife, Jezebel? And Ahab was looking out of his window, and he was so desperately longing. Oh, my neighbor, Naboth, he has such a nice yard. Might be nicer than mine. Oh, man, I'd love to have a vegetable garden. Naboth's yard would look perfect as my garden. And he went and made an offer. But Naboth said, I can't sell you my yard to turn it into your garden. That's my life, my family's inheritance. I can't give you that. Where will my children be? And my children's children? No, that's a thing like this is not done in Israel. So he went home and sulked. And you remember Queen Jezebel. Why, are you not the king? Just do whatever you want. Go have the man killed and then take his land. They say that power corrupts, right? And absolute power corrupts absolutely. And these are the kind of people that Queen Esther is trying to deal with. Now, they're telling Haman, you've got this banquet coming up tomorrow. You don't want it to be ruined. So there's no time to lose. If you're going to kill Mordecai, do it now. Build a massive gallows. And then amazingly, history changed that very night, because the king couldn't sleep. The king couldn't sleep. Sleepless in Susa. What was going to happen? So we're going to revisit chapter 6, verses 1 to 13. It says, that night the king could not sleep, so he ordered the book of the Chronicles, the record of his reign, to be brought in and read. It was found recorded there that Mordecai had exposed Bigthana and Teresh, two of the king's officers, who guarded the door, who had conspired to assassinate King Xerxes. "What honor and recognition has Mordecai received for this?" the king asked. "Nothing has been done for him," his attendants answered. The king said, "Well, who is in the court now?" And now Haman had just entered the outer court of the palace to speak to the king about hanging Mordecai on the gallows he had erected. And his attendants answered, "Well, Haman is standing in the court." "Well, bring him in," the king ordered. When Haman entered, the king asked him, "What should be done for the man the king delights to honor?" Now Haman thought to himself, "Who is there that the king would rather honor than me?" So he answered the king, "For the man the king delights to honor, have them bring a royal robe the king has worn and a horse the king has ridden, one with the royal crest placed on his head. And then let the robe and the horse be entrusted to one of the king's most noble princes, and let them robe the man the king delights to honor, and lead him on the horse through the city streets, proclaiming before him, 'This is what is done for the man the king delights to honor.'" "Go at once," the king commanded Haman. "Get the robe, get the horse, do just as you have suggested for Mordecai the Jew, who sits at the king's gate. Do not neglect anything you have recommended." So Haman got the robe and the horse, and he robed Mordecai and led him on horseback through the city streets, proclaiming, "This is what is done for the man whom the king delights to honor." And afterwards, Mordecai returned to the king's gate, but Haman rushed home with his head covered in grief. And he told Zeresh's wife and all of his friends everything that had happened to him. His advisors and his wife Zeresh said, "Since Mordecai, before whom your downfall has started, is Jewish, you cannot stand against him. You will surely come to ruin." Here we have the king. Couldn't sleep that very night. Why is it the king couldn't sleep that night? Providence. I couldn't help wonder, this was just a delicious thought. The scripture doesn't say this. This is my little speculation. But I just wondered if the trigger for the king not being able to sleep that night is because he kept wondering, what is that incessant banging that's going on? Well, down at Haman's house, they're building a gallows all night long, pound, 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 keeping the king awake. I thought that'd be hysterical. Wonderful poetic justice if that was the case. Now, we don't know the cause of why the king couldn't sleep that night, but we know the causer. We know that God kept him awake for the purposes of his providence. So if you're not sleeping, one of the best tricks is to read something boring. So he invites his chronicler to come in and read to him. He reads about this attempt on his life. No reward was given. How could that be? Providence. No reward was given for Mordecai when he saved his life. The king, in effect, owes his life to Mordecai. Certainly, he needs to do something. What to do? What to do? Now, we have a king here. We've talked several times in the recent weeks about his advisors. He had many advisors to start. He trimmed it down to just his friends, his attendants, his valets. And then he's trimmed it down just to one man, Haman. But this is a man who needs an advisor. Doesn't know what to do. He's kind of an indecisive fellow. In the middle of the night, we should reward this fellow. I need an advisor. What are we going to do? Well, I can hear somebody in the courtyard. Who's here so early in the morning? Haman had come, prepared with a speech. He's got a speech in his heart, and he's ready. I got to tell the king first thing. We got to get this done first thing. I got to tell him how we got to kill Mordecai the Jew. I'm going to hang him. Haman is ready with this. That's why he's there so early. But he doesn't have any chance to get those words out of his mouth. The king speaks first, and the king wants to know, how do we honor somebody? Well, Haman, how delicious. So filled with his own self-worth, so filled with his own pride. Well, of course, there can't be anybody more worthy than myself that the king would want to honor. I've been invited to the queen's banquet. The king must mean me. So Haman proposed honor. He wanted the king's horse. He wanted the king's robes. You know, to me, this very much reminds me of Lucifer, one of the great angels in heaven. The scripture says, his goal and in his heart was to ascend to the throne of the Most High. It wasn't good enough for Lucifer that he could be one of the most beautiful, one of the most special, most precious angels in all of heaven, that all of God's creation. That wasn't good enough. He wanted to ascend like God on Most High and be like him. Here's Haman, second in command to the most powerful man on the entire planet. That's not good enough. I would like to wear the king's robe. I wouldn't mind being on the king's horse. Maybe I could even have the king's crown one day. So he's looking to be top dog, but it's to his horrendous shock that he finds out the one to be honored is Mordecai. And Haman goes home after having done this for Mordecai, who he hates, and he is so painfully embarrassed. Well, just yesterday, he had gone home and he had brought in his wife and his friends, and he's trying to get counsel from them and telling them, this is everything that's going on, and what am I going to do about it? And they gave him his wonderful advice to build a gallows. Now he goes home again, and he needs to be consoled. But instead, when he explains to his wife what has happened, she takes it as being prophetic. She says, oh, if this has happened between you and Mordecai the Jew, there's no hope left for you. Your ruin is sealed. Like it's prophetic, like it's done. You're destined to fall. In essence, I would think the message that she's giving him that's between the lines a little bit is that you really need to flee for your life. It's all fixed now. You will never survive against Mordecai the Jew. You're going to be destined to death. So if anything, the advice should be you better run. But again, in God's providence, there is zero time. Because it says in the scripture, while she was still speaking, the king's servant showed up to take him to the banquet. There is no time. There's no time to change anything. But you must go take him to the ball. Picking it up again, Esther chapter 7. Verses 1 to 10. So the king and Haman went to dine with Queen Esther. And as they were drinking wine on that second day, the king again asked, Queen Esther, what is your petition? It will be given to you. What is your request? Even half the kingdom. It'll be granted. And Queen Esther answered, if I have found favor with you, O king, and if it pleases your majesty, grant me my life. That's my petition. Spare my people. It's my request. I and my people have been sold for destruction. For slaughter, annihilation. You know, if we had merely been sold as male and female slaves, I would have kept quiet because no such distress would justify disturbing the king. But King Xerxes asked Queen Esther, who is it? Where is the man who has dared to do such a thing? And Esther said, the adversary, the enemy. And you can imagine her pointing right across the table. It's this vile Haman. What verse am I on? Does anybody know? 6? Thank you. Then Haman was terrified before the queen and the king. And the king got up in a rage. He left his wine and he went out into the palace garden. But Haman, realizing that the king had already decided his fate, he stayed behind to beg Queen Esther for his life. And just as the king returned from the palace garden to the banquet hall, Haman was falling on the couch where Esther was reclining. And the king exclaimed, would he even molest the queen while she's with me in the house? And as soon as the words left the king's mouth, they covered Haman's face. And then Harbona, one of the eunuchs attending the king, said, a gallows 75 feet high stands by Haman's house. He had it made for Mordecai, the one who spoke up to help the Jews. And the king said, hang him on it. So they hung him on it. Wonderful irony. Haman has come into this viewing the queen as his ally. She is enamored with me like everybody else is and wants me at the banquet. That's how he sees her. But in verse 6, she identifies him as this wicked enemy. Now when the king hears all of this, he's so angry he has to excuse himself and leave the room. It's a little bit of wisdom. Get some air. Think a little bit here. The king, who is so addicted to his advisors, as it seems, finds himself standing in the garden with no advisors and nobody to help him. When Queen Vashti had a problem, he had a whole team of advisors. Maybe the king is stupid to be taking too much advice about how to deal with his wife from a group of other men. But here he is with no advisors. What am I going to do? Well, if he has no idea what he's going to do, God is going to make sure he knows fully well what to do when he walks back into the room and he sees there, by again God's providence, that Haman, who has decided he has to save himself, his only hope is to address and plead the king, but he stumbles. Why did this man stumble as he was coming to the queen? The text doesn't tell us why, other than we know the causer who caused it, God himself. Was it too much drink? Maybe. Was he nervous? Maybe. Did God put a little feather there to make sure he fell? Probably. The king comes in and sees this going on, and if he's not sure what to do, he's sure at that moment. This man looks as though he's about to molest my wife right here in my house. The king is in a rage. It's amazing. I love this one little fellow, this servant Harbona. You know, his name is recorded in the books in heaven. Harbona, the servant, who otherwise keeps his mouth shut like every other servant does. But in this moment, for some reason, Harbona, who normally, like every other servant, would keep his mouth shut, happens to speak up and says, "Oh, king, by the way, this fellow just spent the night building a big gallows to kill the man." How handy. Haman's fate is sealed. And when you think about all of these events, and who was in charge? Who was in charge of all these events? We have a king, so powerful as he. Was he in charge? We have the queen preparing the banquets and preparing the speeches. Is she in charge? We got Haman, who's second in command and thinks he's so very powerful, got the world by the tail. Was he in charge? The king was the most powerful man in the world. But yet in him and all of his power and all of his kingdom and all of his advisors put together are no match, not remotely, to God. You know what is wonderful as we begin to see the providence of God? It's so good for your faith when you begin to see it in your own life, the providence of God, that God is moving, that God is working and doing things. Even when you've not yet asked him, God is sovereign and he is working. So many times the unsaved, things happen and they don't see the providence of God. And they just find frustration. But for the born again, if you begin to see God's hand as he works through his providence, it's like watching the most skilled workers. If you see a magnificent bowl and you think, that's a beautiful thing. But then you get to see that day where that skilled craftsman is working on that bowl and you marvel. If that were me and I'd take a chisel and I'd bust the whole thing right away. And here's this man working on this thing and he's so skilled. And this beautiful product at the end. Or you hear a song and you think, wow, that's wonderful. And if you got to sit with that musician while they were going through that and see the genius that comes out of them and you try and write a song and that's not what I got. And this creative person who puts something together that's so fabulous. This is what it's like, but even greater so when through the eyes of faith we begin to see our God, the master of all perfect skill, weaving his providence to accomplish his ends in this life. You know, so many people can't. I've had a number of moments in my life where I've argued with God, and Lord, forgive me, when I should not have, because he's doing things where I'm just frustrated and I don't understand. I want to show you a passage from Jacob in the scriptures. From the book of Genesis. Jacob, being a great patriarch of the father of the 12. You remember Abraham, of course. When Abraham is called by God, you should sacrifice your son Isaac. Here's a man of faith who says, I will do what God has asked me, even though it sounds crazy. And God didn't make him sacrifice his son. We know that. Two generations later, we're looking at his grandson, Jacob. And his son, Joseph, has been held hostage in Egypt in all those years, and they're asking him, you need to let us have your young son, Benjamin, to go. Otherwise, we've got others that are kept held in prison by the Pharaoh. We need Benjamin. He doesn't want to let him go. He won't let his son go like his grandfather would do. He doesn't have those same eyes of faith. He wouldn't let Benji go. Can I just read to you Genesis 42, 36? Have we got that? Oh, we don't have that? How did that happen? Must be providence. Genesis 42, verse 36. It says, their father Jacob said, you have deprived me of my children. Joseph is no more. Simeon is no more. And now you want to take Benjamin. Everything is against me. Everything is against me. Here's a man. He is God's chosen. And he's saying, everything is against me. Why does God kept Joseph in Egypt all that time? Why does God want to get Jacob and Benjamin there in Egypt? You guys know why? He wants to save them. He's going to save their family. He's going to save the whole future nation from the 7-year drought that's coming. God's going to save them. And yet there's Jacob saying, with all these events, it's just all against me. Somehow we need to learn to grow in our faith that we can trust the providence of God. And when things are happening and they don't seem like they are going our way, that we can trust. Romans 8:28, you guys should know this verse by now, right? Romans 8:28, that God causes all things to work together for good for those who love him and those who are called according to his purpose. So if you're a child of God and you love him, he's working all things out for good. This is his providence in your life. Even when things don't look good in those particular moments, God says he is still working for good. Now, when you look at the story that we're going through, neither Esther nor Mordecai had any influence. They didn't have any influence over the king's sleep. There was nothing they could do to affect that the king would not have a good sleep that night, that he would have to wake up. They had no influence over which chronicles would be read that would reveal to him that Mordecai hadn't been rewarded and these things that set all these events into action. They had no influence over the fact that Mordecai's reward would have been delayed. They had no influence over the fact that Haman, in his critical moment, would trip and fall right into the queen's lap so that the king would be enraged. They had no influence over Harbona, a servant who's supposed to keep his mouth shut, but would open it at just that moment and signal to all of them, I know how to take care of Haman. He's already got a gallows built. They didn't have any influence in all that, but God did. And his timing is perfect. His timing for Mordecai not to get his reward. We have those moments, why, Lord, is this not coming? Why, Lord, do I have to wait for this? He's got a reason. For the king's insomnia on that night, for Haman's early arrival at work, God's timing is perfect. Oh, how I pray that your faith would be challenged and strengthened today to know and to trust the things that you're waiting for, you're wondering about. No, God's timing is perfect. He's not wrong. The devil does not have these powers. The devil is like Haman. Haman was impaled on his own pole. What he had set up to do wicked and evil, he's the one who ends up hanging on that. The devil, too, will swing from his own gallows. When you consider, church, we're going to go have communion here in just a minute where we remember what Christ has done for us. And you know, surely, in those moments, as Jesus was heading towards the cross, and if you were in the devil's court and you think things are working out just perfectly now that the Son of God will be eliminated, they're going to crucify him. And to see Jesus on the cross and think this is it, we're getting the victory that we want. But of course the devil did not get the victory he wanted. There he is thinking the best plan he could ever have and the greatest outcome that he could ever have to see God's only Son being eliminated. And we know, of course, Jesus was not eliminated. He's raised from the dead, all power and authority given to him in heaven and under heaven and on the earth. And all of our hope and salvation comes because of the victory that Jesus had. Didn't matter how it looked beforehand, didn't matter how it seemed, God got the complete victory. And we still have and live in that today. So we're going to celebrate in that now. We're going to celebrate together. The church, the scripture encourages us This is the kind of thing that we are encouraged to do, to take communion, so that we remember rightly and properly the great victory that Jesus had and what he had done for us. You know what? In the book of Esther, she has so many banquets. And in these banquets, she comes to the point where to the king she will finally reveal her identity. And in that same banquet, she will expose Haman as the evil one. Jesus talked about the cross like a cup. He's speaking to his disciples. Are you going to take this cup that I'm going to take? Like a banquet. And yet when Jesus goes to the cross, for everybody who's wondering, everybody who thought he's such a great teacher, he's just like Elijah. Who do people say that I am? Jesus asked. Well, maybe you're Elijah come back or John the Baptist. He says, no. You're missing the mark if you think that I'm just a great teacher. I'm the Messiah. And when he goes to the cross, like Esther having her identity finally revealed of who she really is, Jesus' identity is revealed for the whole world. Because he goes to the cross and he comes back for all of us. Esther said, if I perish, I perish. And Jesus did. And he exposed and defeated the devil. Praise be to God. So at this point, church, I'm going to invite our deacons and our servers, if they'll come forward. We're going to prepare ourselves to worship through communion.